Well, his name is Dr. Paul LaViolette, and he is a scientist and a darn good one. He has authored 4 books and has published numerous articles in professional scientific journals. He received his BA in physics from Johns Hopkins University, his MBA from the University of Chicago, his PhD in systems science and astronomy from Portland State University, and he's the president of Starburst Foundation, which is a scientific research institute. Dr. LaViolette, his findings open a new pathway to the interpretation of our ancient past. Aided by his background in general system theory and physics, he's been able to successfully decipher the lost science said to be encoded in the lore of the tarot and astrology, and he has done just a magnificent job in some of the theories and opinions you are about to hear tonight. Paul, I've got to tell you, I was watching your videos in compliment to the books, and I was just glued to what I was seeing and hearing about these theories. How long have you been working on this?
Oh, many years, decades.
Well, how did you come across this? I mean, well, something obviously sparked your interest many years ago for you to begin to say, you know, there's something else out there in the cosmos. There's something that's affected this planet. How did you then push yourself in that direction?
Actually, I was coming from physics. It may sound unusual to be discovering something like this, studying physics. But I was developing a new theory in physics because, being curious, I wanted to understand better what was going on in the universe, and was actually developing a systems approach, I was taking ideas from systems theory, which has now come to be quite well established in many fields, but it hadn't been applied to physics at that time. And as I was going through this, as a friend said, geez, your theory sounds a lot like what's in the tarot. And that's what sort of introduced me to the ancient traditions, and I saw indeed that these concepts that I was developing were encoded there, and one thing led to another. I found that astrology, which is another system of its encoding concepts metaphorically, also encoded this science, and then it was like one discovery after another. I began to realize that the constellations, which astrology is basically 12 constellations along the ecliptic, were pointing out the location of the galactic center. And as I understood what it was saying, metaphorically, through its symbolism, it was indicating that the center of our galaxy had exploded on a certain past date. And at that time, I was in the PhD program at Portland State.
Okay.
And I had been planning before that to be developing my new physics theory that I had been working on. But when I made this discovery, that sort of went on the shelf. I figured this was much more important. Here was something that astronomers and geologists had totally missed. It was a phenomenon that affects the Earth periodically, in a very big way, and which has been the source of the ancient legends about the Great Flood, the burning of the earth, the dark sky where the sun is blotted out or the stars are blotted out, earthquakes, global earthquakes.
And what astounds me, Paul, is the work that you've done by picking up some of the ancient myths of civilizations that apparently had some knowledge of this. And that's what's pretty perplexing. I mean, the Hopis in a number of other civilizations on this planet all talk about some catastrophes that have occurred way before they existed. How did they know about this?
Yes, so they apparently were handing down the knowledge from distant past. And you find this tradition being passed down in all cultures. It seems that Western society, or modern scientific society we live in has sort of disbelieved what the legends are saying. They didn't have a category to interpret them. There was a reaction against interpreting, for example, geology was a reaction against the theorists that were trying to find a cause or evidence for the Great Flood, who were coming from religious background. Geology grew out of the opposition of that and developed the glacial theory, which was more of a very slow, progressive type of agent that would try to explain a lot of the geologic formations. So there was this sort of reaction against catastrophism in science.
Now, Paul, the Hopis, for example, they've talked in their history of three worlds that came before this one. And we're now in what they would call world number four. They talked that that each of those other three worlds ended when a blue star appeared. Now, on the face of it, somebody would say, all right, what do we mean by a blue star? But you go on to explain, and then when you go back and look at Hopi prophecy, it makes sense. The blue star we're talking about really has to do with the center of the Milky Way, this nuclei within this galaxy, right?
Right. When the galactic core erupts, it would give off a bluish white light, just like in the myth they talk about, or in the legend. In effect, you would see a star brighter than any other star in the sky. It would probably be visible during the day. So there would be almost like two suns, but this would be sort of a point of light in the sky.
And this heats up galactic dust, which could be devastating to us.
Well, yeah, in a way. What it does is it's actually a wind of cosmic rays that have arrived. The light is produced from the cosmic rays. It's called synchrotron radiation.
Okay.
We discovered it in the particle accelerators when they were observing. They saw this bluish-white light coming from the electrons. And that's what happens when electrons are slowed down. They give up a lot of their kinetic energy as this bluish-white light, which is all frequencies, radio waves on up to X-rays and gamma rays. And it would be beamed in the forward direction that the particles were traveling. And when you see the bluish-white light, that means that the superwave, as I call it, has already arrived. And superwave being the cosmic rays released from the center of the galaxy, which is 23,000 light years away from us.
And that arrives really without warning then, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Oh, because they're now, think of this superwave. It's traveling essentially at the speed of light. So when it arrives, when we become aware of it, it's already at our doorstep. You see reference to the day of the Lord in the Bible arriving like a thief in the night. And
okay,
that really describes this.
And then according to Hopi, then, if you interpret it this way, you think this this cosmic explosion in the center of the Milky Way, which sent this wave our way, has happened already three times, at least?
At least you can see from the repetition of this, you look at the past and see how many times, what was the period between these, and you can kind of project it, or at least two of these on their way right now towards us.
Already?
Yes, it's just we don't know when the closest one's going to arrive.
Okay.
Although you get predictions about catastrophes coming up soon, thing is that we don't really know.
There have been
predictions that have something was going to happen at the turn of the century that never panned out.
What about the, you know, the Mayans, Paul? Their 2012 calendar. Could this be anything that has to do with the cosmic wave?
Sure. Very possibly. If you look at the beginning of the Mayan calendar, the exact date slips me, but it was around 3000 BC, you find a small event occurring about that time. If you look at the glacial ice record, and the thing to look for is beryllium 10, which is produced in the atmosphere when cosmic rays strike the atmosphere.
And you were so, you were one of the few people to get some ice core samples, weren't you?
Well, I was the first to get them from Russia.
Okay,
so that was sort of introducing the U.S. Soviet ice core exchange program.
I understand.
But a lot of scientists have been analyzing ice from both North and South Poles. But a lot of times I use other people's data. I've done my own research on ice for my PhD work, which was to test this theory. I was looking for cosmic dust in the Ice Age period. But some of the other work that's relating to the cosmic rays, the beryllium 10 profile, I was taking other people's data there. And if you look at that, you see distinctive peaks. Now, I had actually been predicting this in the thesis in my dissertation, and later this data came out to show, in fact, that there were these peaks. And judging from the periods, you can figure the period between these events, but it's not regular. It's, there's a certain amount of erraticness to it. But you do see a small peak around 5,300 years ago. And it was enough to do some small effects to climate. For example, in Peru, in the Andes, they found there's a glacier there in the mountains.
Right.
And they found some plant material flat that had been flash frozen to the point it was like perfectly preserved in the ice, as if a sudden hailstorm had buried this. And that was about the same time you had the case of the Iceman in the in the Alps.
And is this also like when they find a woolly mammoth frozen, it still has vegetation in its mouth?
Right, like the mammoths. Now, that was a different event further back, but like they would have been buried in ice water that would have preserved them. Exactly. You found some climatic changes also occurring at that time. Now, this small event is more speculative because I don't have the astronomical data to back it up, although it's interesting you find a cosmic ray peak there. And it turns out that the Mayan calendar begins within a century of that time. Now, whether the next one is going to arrive on 2012, that would mean the Mayans had some advanced knowledge. Where did they get that knowledge?
Well, that's a good point. Hey, Paul, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and then we'll be right back with you. Paul's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. And I've got to tell you, as we get more into this, is absolutely startling. Next hour, as a matter of fact, with Paul, we're going to talk about his theory of pulsars, which he believes to come from extraterrestrials, a form of intergalactic communication. But for now, when we come back, we'll be talking with Paul LaViolette about his theories about Earth under fire, this cosmic wave, a couple of them, he believes, are heading this way, has no idea when they will hit. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette. Paul, so we don't know when this cosmic wave is heading this way, other than we know that there have been two bursts out this way. How do we know that?
Those are recorded in the ice core record. You mean about the ones coming to us?
Yeah, the two that are coming. Who knows when they'll get here?
When I say two, I mean the very, very large ones that are going to be so large that they'll change the climate. There are other smaller ones, I believe, which they're going to be strong enough to do, let's say, damage to our satellites, communication equipment. They could create effects similar to high-altitude nuclear explosion in terms of EMP, where, for example, could burn out solid-state circuits in cars and so on.
Instantly.
Right. So whatever the warnings they have for a nuclear EMP, that could occur from one of the smaller events. These are much more frequent. In fact, if you look, astronomers have looked at towards the galactic center, and they see clouds of gas that are expanding that appear to have been blown out from the core. And judging from the rate of expansion and their size, they can get dates when these puffs came out. And there appear to be 14 of these clouds or these expulsions in the last 6,000 years. And judging from these small events, you can see the spacing is an average of every 500 years. And we haven't had one for the last 700 years. So from that, you can conclude that we're overdue for a small one. Now, 700 years ago, we didn't have satellites and all that. We didn't have electrical appliances. So we really wouldn't have, it wouldn't have impacted our life that much back in the days of riding horses and so on. It could be really disastrous if it happened today.
Well, Paul, this year the sun has been very active. It's not supposed to be. As a matter of fact, we're supposed to be on a downturn. But, you know, it has been very active. We've been lucky that some of these coronal mass ejections haven't been faced directly to us. We'd have some real problems. Does this cosmic wave, when it hits, does it also affect the sun? And if so, how does it?
Yes, definitely. For one thing, the dust that it pushes in would come in, sort of shroud the sunlight, would form a dust cocoon around the sun. It would also activate the sun to become more of a flaring type of star. We see stars like this. They're called T Tauri stars. They're surrounded by dust. They're similar to our sun. It's just they have a dust around them, and they're continually erupting with flares.
It looks like the star's on fire, by literally, all around it, right?
The photosphere of the star actually expands. It's become so energized. If you can imagine solar flares that are going on continuously, whereas today we have a cycle where it's not only continuous, but there's always flares on the surface of the star. And sometimes several eruptions at one time that could add up to a very large coronal mass ejection. Much more powerful, much more frequent, much more X-ray radiation being given off. This could cause, for example, geomagnetic flips when they hit.
I got to tell you, too, Paul, I was amazed in the video, Earth Under Fire, how many mainstream scientists accept this theory of yours. They're coming on board. They're not throwing this away. They're not laughing at this. They're taking it pretty seriously, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, so far the theory has made 13 or 14 predictions, a priori predictions that were published and later verified, which is pretty good track record.
Yeah, I think so, too. Do you believe that when these hit, in your opinion, it could come sooner than later? I mean, might we be, and I know you don't know the exact date here, but I mean, God willing, we're talking about thousands and thousands of years away, but my take is that you think it might happen much sooner.
Yes, I give a 90% chance it would happen in the next, let's say, 300 or 400 years.
Okay.
Which, doesn't mean it might not happen 2012 or sooner. You really can only go by probabilities based on the past. What we really need is some information, let's say, suppose that there were civilizations living closer to the the core, to the galactic core.
Right.
That knew the time that the wave passed there, and they were able to relay to civilizations further out to know exactly when this would arrive. Really, you'd have to go to a more advanced culture out in space.
Now, how many civilizations knew about some of the past cosmic waves that practically destroyed the planet and life as they knew it at the time?
Well, you mean how many cultures? Or
Yeah. I mean, we've got the Hopis as one. There were numerous ones, weren't there?
All over the planet. Virtually every culture has stories about this.
All similar stories.
Right. It's amazing. In my book, Earth Under Fire, I have a page that I list just for the flood stories, the various cultures. I don't know if I can find it right now.
Okay, and this is the flood, of course, we know in the Bible, the one that the Noah was involved in. Is that the
right,
one?
Right, yeah. In fact, there's one book that was written that they thought it was due to the Mediterranean overflowing through into the Black Sea, which would have been a very local event.
Does this cosmic wave, Paul, create a tsunami and high waves?
Yes, it would create earthquake effects. But what I was saying, that in actuality, this event of the flood was something you find in stories all over. It's not just a localized. These are not localized myths. You find them in North America, Siberia, South America, Japan, China.
Do they all talk like the Hopis of an impending cosmic wave again?
Well, they talk about cycles. This is a theme that you find very frequently, that there are cycles of destruction which end ages. In my book, I have a whole chapter on cycles of destruction. I've studied cultures from around the world that have this theme, and they're very similar in many respects. It's just the kind of destruction that ends the age varies from one culture to another, or like, for example, in the Hopi myths or one given culture, they will have a different destruction for each cycle. But in actuality, all of these things are happening. It's not just one thing.
I've got to ask you, as we talk about the Hopi, and I don't know if you got involved in this end of it or not, Paul, but they have also drawings of what they call ant people, very similar to gray aliens that we talk about today. The large heads, the little bodies, the long fingers. Might we be talking about the same thing, extraterrestrial visitation, and the Hopis knew about this?
Well, they talk about their peoples being led by a cloud to some underground kivas to weather out the event. So this sounds a lot like some close encounter. You know.
Yeah, it does.
In other myths of the Hopi, they talk about it being as a light in the sky that they were following. At one point in this event, I believe it was a coronal mass ejection that hit the Earth and actually ignited the surface. You find actually a black horizon down there at a certain level, which is between what the geologists refer to as the Alarod period and Younger Dryas.
Yes.
And it's called in Europe the Ucello horizon. A geologist I met a few years back, Hans Klusterman, was researching this, and he found it all over Europe. It's actually about 10 centimeter blackened layer. And he was doing studies over here, too. He finds it in the southwest, although here, geologists will just say, "Oh, well, that's just a mat, that black mat, maybe due to certain lichens or something that discolor it." And yet, it occurs at the same boundary, at the time of the extinction of the mammals, the mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers. We had 95% of the large animals die off in this continent at that time.
And was it instant, the die-off?
That's difficult to say, but virtually you see a termination boundary as to how long it actually took for the extinction to happen. We don't know, but in terms of geologic time, it was essentially abrupt. You did find increased mortality for the previous couple thousand years, but then there was this boundary beyond which you didn't find the bones anymore of those animals, and they are buried in flood deposits. They are also you find them in Alaska, but there the flood deposits were frozen as tundra. So you're able to see the bodies, even the soft parts, preserved.
Paul, do you think governments are aware of this? You know, do they listen to experts like you and say, you know what, we better start developing, because we got this great technology, we better start developing some kind of shield, something to save this planet. And we're not just talking about trying to deflect, for example, an asteroid. We got to shield this planet. Do you think they're aware in doing things like that?
I don't know as far as what's happening in the classified side of things. As far as the scientific programs that are funded today, I don't see that happening. And I think what's needed is more of an awareness. It's sort of like there's a critical mass of awareness that you have to pass, and we haven't got to that point yet. Maybe your program will help, where scientists start talking about it. There are some that have cited my papers and have written my papers where I've written about this, but it hasn't gotten to the point where it's being taught in colleges or it's part of the strategy for the, let's say, for FEMA and this sort of thing. It's very far from that. Even after the tsunami, on my website, I have a page where I connect the gamma ray burst with the tsunami. I believe the two were connected. They happened within 2 days of each other.
And I guess that's been documented, right? The burst, and then obviously the timing with the tsunami?
Yes, but they did not release immediately the information about the gamma ray burst. The first was the tsunami on December 26, 2004. And then about 2 days later occurred the gamma ray burst, but we didn't hear about it until middle of February, which is a pity. But anyway, once it was released, there was some discussion on the internet about somebody was asking, could these two have been related? And one of the scientists, I know NASA scientist or somebody, was saying, well, there's no way that gamma rays could have created an earthquake, and besides, it occurred afterwards. The missing link here is the gravity wave. When you get a burst like that, now, first of all, let me say that this gamma ray burst was 100 times stronger than the next strongest gamma ray burst they'd ever observed in their history.
100 times?
Right. The reason was it occurred within our galaxy, actually at about as far away as the center of the galaxy. It's really interesting that it was only about a source that was only about 10 degrees of arc away from the center of the galaxy and about as far away. And
of course, what are the odds of it hitting us at about the same time that this earthquake/tsunami would occur? So one has to assume that there's some kind of correlation between the two.
Right. Well, the gravity wave would arrive first before the gamma rays, because the gamma rays are deflected by gravity fields and dust particles and so on. So they're going to arrive a little later. Also, there's a theory that at the time it's initially created, at the time of the initial explosion, the gravity pulse will actually be superluminal and then slow down to luminal speed. So it could actually, that part could actually get a head start, whereas gamma rays are normal electromagnetic waves. They would be going to speed of light. So you find that the largest gamma ray pulse that had ever been observed occurring 2 days after an earthquake, which was 10 times larger than the largest quake anywhere in the world to occur in the last 25 years. And that can't be just a coincidence. The two gamma ray gravity wave telescopes groups. There's one that's the LIGO group here in the U.S., and there's another one in Japan. And unfortunately, neither were up and running at the time to have observed the event. So we are unable to confirm about the gravity wave. But this would explain why the events are tied together.
Well, you know, these events, these cosmic waves, have probably had such a devastating effect on the planet. I've got to ask you, do you think, if you believe Atlantis truly existed at one time, that a cosmic wave might have wiped out that continent as well?
Well, I believe that Atlantis, really what we had was a civilization, an Ice Age civilization. Of course, you could say that there were people at times living in caves. Of course, they had to go into caves to get shelter from this. But you would have had a civilization along the coastal areas. In fact, Graham Hancock was doing studies of Malta, for example, and they found underwater ruins in Malta, for example,
right,
that date back to the end of the Ice Age. We find stone monuments in Peru, in Baalbek, in Near East, made with very large stone blocks. The question is, where did they get the technology to build these things? So you see evidence for advanced civilization living on our planet, and what's left are the stones, basically. If there was, if we were using iron, it would have rusted away. Yes, but as far as a continent like Atlantis, I don't believe that there was an island with moats and dikes around it, like Plato says, because Plato is reporting about Solon's trip to Egypt, and Solon is told by the priests there that this myth, this story, is to be taken metaphorically. And
okay,
he gives an example there about Phaethon and the sun chariot, and he says, now this is told as a story, but this really is conveying about certain celestial bodies, their paths, and about a conflagration that occurred on the Earth.
Okay, stay with us, Paul. We're going to be back at the top of the hour. The talk of the galaxy, he believes that pulsars are ET messages. You know, the first pulsar was discovered by chance by Joslyn Bell and Anthony Hoish in 1967, who actually thought they were going to study distant galaxies at the time. They have since, people have found, astronomers, at least 1,500 pulsars to date now, maybe more. At one time, they thought that they might be coming from an extraterrestrial civilization. Well, and most scientists simply said, no, that's just not the case. However, Paul, another riveting theory here, the talk of the galaxy. Let's talk a little bit. First of all, in scientific terms, let's talk about these pulsars. Technically, what do they seem to be?
Okay, well, we have to come up with a new model to explain these, because what you see is that they're, the most unusual ones are located at key places in the galaxy. They're making geometrical relationships to the center of the galaxy and to the two closest supernova remnants, whose detonation times were at the time this superwave passed us at the end of the Ice Age. Ruling out just random occurrence, because if you do the statistics on this, if this was due to chance, you're coming up with something like one chance in 10 to the 28th power It's just a huge number has been due to just random chance for this, these alignments to occur.
Sure.
So the idea of a spinning neutron star that was proposed years back to explain this has problems with a lot of aspects, that it doesn't, there's a lot of contradictions. This has been noted by many astronomers, that as they discover more and more about the phenomenon, they find it's more complex than they thought. In fact, even on a given pulsar, the various characteristics will become self-contradictory in terms of the model that they had, this idea of a neutron star that was spinning and shooting out a beam of radiation that would periodically sweep by in our direction. The model that I've proposed is that they are neutron stars, and neutron stars that are emitting cosmic rays.
Mm-hmm.
But a civilization has used them as energy sources for transmitting pulse synchrotron beams towards us. And it would be done in this fashion. They would project to the surface of the neutron star force fields that would be able to decelerate the cosmic rays. Now, this is a technology that's been developed in black programs, and we know of it from various stories. For example, I interviewed a lady who was, had been on a camping trip in the Superstitious Mountains in Arizona, and they were woken up at night, and they look up in the sky, and here are these luminous spheres rising up from behind the mountain, going up and splitting into several spheres, doing various circles around, and then eventually coming back down behind the mountain. And this was going on for hours. Apparently, that was near a military installation, and it seems that what they were observing was a military test of a technology for being able to create force fields in the sky. And Tom Bearden has talked a lot about this technology.
Yes.
He refers to these as scalar waves that are used. In my book, Talk of the Galaxy, I give an explanation of how these can be produced. I believe that this is used by advanced civilizations to create these beams remotely. So they would have their generators for this a ways away from the neutron star, but they would be able to actually create on the surface these disks that would beam out the radiation. And it would be almost like a laser, because the cosmic rays are going close to the speed of light. So when they are decelerated and they produce the synchrotron radiation, it ends up being confined as a beam. So just by turning on and off the disk, they're able to create this pulse phenomenon.
What do you think the purpose of the message might be, Paul?
I think that they're warning us about the superwave. At least the pulsars that are uniquely placed. It's not to say that all the pulsars are involved in this message. I believe that their second purpose is to be used for guidance and interstellar space travel.
Now, how many of these pulsars are aimed at planet Earth as opposed to being beamed all around the universe, basically,
okay,
or the galaxy?
We're seeing now, we've detected about 1,530, and all the pulsars that we're seeing, those beams are directed towards our sector of the galaxy.
Now, isn't that strange all by itself?
They're beamed towards us.
Okay.
Because if you're outside the beam, you're not going to see it. So this is a model where you don't have a beam sweeping around. You have a stationary beam. In other words, if for navigation, for example, a spaceship would use these as sort of a GPS system to be able to locate itself.
I wonder if it would power itself. Is that possible?
Well, yeah, because they're using the neutron stars, which are natural sources of cosmic rays, as the power source. When I first was thinking about this, I thought, well, it wouldn't be too hard to create a power source, let's say with a nuclear reactor or something out in space, and use that to power accelerators. I mean, we have the technology to do that type of system very easily, to send a pulsed synchrotron beam to another star. But when you realize that the pulsars that are in binary systems are, they're able to look at the orbital dynamics of the pulsar, and the equations work out that it has to be a fairly massive object, about a solar mass or more. So you're sort of left to the idea that these are using neutron stars as their power source.
Paul, what is SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence? What do they say about your theory?
Well, I did call up their office and offered to send them a copy of my book, and they didn't want it.
They didn't want it?
That the fellow I spoke to, name is Shostak.
Seth Shostak.
Right. Said he asked me, has it been published in any referee journals? I said no. And so because of that, he didn't even want to take a look at it.
Next time we have Seth on the show, because he pops up quite often, I'll kind of mention this book to him, see what
now,
he says.
The reason why I haven't, there's a reason, is that to understand this requires a long discussion. It's really a book-length discussion. And that's not something that's done easily in a scientific paper. I have presented at the American Astronomical Society a presentation of highlighting a few of the main points.
How was that received?
I didn't get any criticism at all. There was a couple questions at the end, and then people scurried off to their other meetings because there were simultaneously many sessions going on. Actually, at that meeting, this was in year 2000, and I made a video of that lecture in case people are interested, the Talk of the Galaxy video. I had a booth there and had the manuscript. It was in the early stages, but I had manuscripts available for astronomers if they were interested. And I stopped and interviewed them, asked if they were interested in extraterrestrial communication. And about half weren't really interested. But of the other half, two-thirds were willing to come and listen to what I had to say. And then the other third didn't believe, it would be possible we'd be contacted, even though they were interested.
Well, these pulses, Paul, obviously it's not Morse code. So what is the code? How do we decipher these messages, these pulses?
Well, I haven't actually deciphered the signals. What I've noticed is their locations. And through their locations, there's a geometrical message that they're conveying. But there may indeed be a message in the signals themselves. In fact, I have some data from one pulsar, the Vela pulsar. And it's a matter of getting the people interested to do the analysis and who have the equipment.
Can it be decoded eventually, you think, if indeed your theory is correct?
Oh, yeah. It's a matter if there is interest to do it, it could be done. If there is information in the signal, there should be non-randomness to that, the emission. Current theories, even though they talk about the pulses being regular in terms of the lighthouse model beam sweeping by, the actual generation of the emissions is supposed to be more or less erratic, just due to cosmic rays coming and interacting with the magnetic field. So it would be totally surprising if there was an order to the signals themselves. So that's definitely the next test. It would be to look at the signal.
I want to read a quote from the back of your book because it's important and you'll understand when it's done. Dr. Paul LaViolette systematically and eloquently presents an audacious hypothesis that the signals and locations of many pulsars provide evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. Whatever the significance of his data and conclusions, this is a book well worth reading by those who ponder the great questions of life and the cosmos. That quote, given to you by our dear friend, the late Dr. Eugene Mallove, who was murdered almost a couple years ago. That sad story all by itself, Paul, but what a wonderful individual he was. Yes. Obviously, thought very highly of your work.
Yes, was very supportive. I can give you an idea. I'm on your website. I had put a picture of a certain part of the galaxy showing some pulsars, which would help to illustrate. This is something that's difficult to convey over the phone unless you have pictures. I don't know. Most of the people probably aren't in front of a computer.
Well, we get a lot in front of a computer, believe it or not. Pretty computer savvy group here.
Well, there is this picture I put there of the Sagitta constellation region. It's a sky map, and it's plotted in terms of galactic coordinates. So horizontal would be the galactic equator, and then vertical would be the angular distance away from there. And I plotted locations of pulsars. And the reason I picked this particular place to look at is that there's a point there about 57.24 degrees from the galactic center, which is what I call the galactic one radian point. Now, this is something that the radian concept is something that you would expect could be used in an extraterrestrial communication. Because in extraterrestrial communication, you want to pick concepts that would be universal, like in mathematics, for example, sure, or physics, that would be understandable to those other civilizations. So you're trying to bridge the language barrier. And with the radian concept, what you're doing is you're taking the radius of the circle and you're mapping it out around the circumference. And you come to a angle in terms of our degree system. It comes out to 57.295 degrees. That they have actually indicated this point in the galaxy where the center, the other end of that arc, would be at the galactic center. So in other words, they've swept out one radian from the galactic center, and they put a very unique pulsar there to mark it. I show this there. It's the pulsar 1937 plus 21. It's a millisecond pulsar. In fact, it's the fastest pulsing pulsar in the sky.
Is this a roadmap kind of leading us to them?
What it shows is they're not all hostile. They're actually, there's a very highly developed galactic civilization or group of civilizations that are trying to help us. They're trying to warn us about this phenomenon, which would be the natural thing to talk about.
Okay, what makes you think, because we haven't been able to decode this, what makes you think that's the message, that they're warning us about a cosmic wave as opposed to a message of, hey, we're out here, I'm calling, something like that?
Right. Okay, well, if you take that one radian arc and instead of sweeping it out angularly or to the side,
all right,
you take as a measuring tape, now think of it as a measuring tape, and you go from the galactic center to us, you'll find it ends right where we are. So in other words, if we're at the center of the circle and the galactic center is on the circumference, that angular distance they're measuring for us is the distance from the center of the galaxy to us.
Okay.
Then you look at our neighborhood and you see that the two most unique pulsars in our neighborhood, and actually are among the most unique in the entire sky, are marking supernova remnants that like the Vela, which is the closest of the young supernova remnants, closest to the solar system. And then the Crab Nebula, which is the youngest, closest supernova remnant that's the youngest of all, because it only happened about 970 or so years ago, when 1054 AD, when the Chinese astronomers noted the explosion in the
sky. So they might be sending us some old messages, huh? Or do you think it's just continual?
The pulsars?
Yeah.
To have done this feat, it means they had to be there in the sky a long time, because some of these pulsars are 50,000 light years away. In other words, this was you're left to in disbelief because you see the immensity of the project that would have been necessary for all these signals from different points in the galaxy to arrive and spell out this message. And you realize how, we certainly couldn't have done it. How could anybody else have done it? I mean, the only other alternative you're left with is the universe is conscious, and it's trying to communicate to us that this is a spiritual phenomenon. In Talk of the Galaxy, I've tried to put it in terms of, it could be also explained by a civilization that has exceptionally advanced technologies. In some places, they would have had to actually, I believe, move neutron stars through the sky to do this, to position them in the proper place. Because the chances of them finding a neutron star at the exact right place is very difficult to imagine. They've also, in one case, oriented the orbital plane of the binary, so it's passing in our direction, the so-called eclipsing binary. There is very uniquely, for example, the second fastest pulsing pulsar has its orbital plane oriented towards us, and it's only about 5 degrees away from the other pulsar we just mentioned, the millisecond pulsar.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to talk some. I want to get your take on the Big Bang Theory, Paul, when we come back with our guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette. Paul, do these pulsar signals ever die out, or do they just keep coming over and over again?
Yeah, they've been there for quite a while, and they keep coming to us. So that's the nice thing about it is that there's a phenomenon that's persisting long enough that scientists are able to document it. All this stuff that I discuss in my book has been published in refereed scientific journals. So there's no question that it exists. People can see what I've written and go to the original papers, check all the calculations, and they will, if they've read carefully what I've said, come to the same conclusion that either this is just a random occurrence that's totally freak, like one chance in 10 to the 28th or 10 to the 30th, or there's some sort of planning here where there was an intent. I wanted to finish up what I was saying about why it is that this had led me to conclude that it was a message dealing with the superwave. It has to do with those two supernova remnants I mentioned. It's sort of like they're calling attention to these two remnants. And when you go and you look at the times when the supernova occurred, they occurred at the time that the superwave was passing through, passing that star. In other words, it's as if the superwave detonated the explosion. Perhaps it was the gravity wave that was associated with the superwave that could have been enough to trigger an unstable star to explode. Or it could have been dust that it was being pushed onto the star that caused it to become active and explode. Whatever the cause, you look at the timing of the explosions relative to the position of where the superwave would have been, and you see that there was this effect. It sort of maps out the superwave as it proceeded away from the galactic center. First, it was the Vela supernova explosion, which occurred about 800 light years from us, very close to us, and that would have been way back about 12,000 years ago or so. Then the Crab supernova occurred, which was in the direction away from the galactic center. So it's sort of like mapping out the direction of the progress. And actually, it was this, because at the time I was studying pulsars and becoming amazed about their regularity and so on. And when I saw this, that was actually a key piece of information that helped me realize about the galactic superwave phenomena. Because I had at that time, just before that, discovered about the message of Sagittarius arrow indicating from myth about the Sagittarius aiming at the heart of the scorpion, and that trajectory passing very close to the galactic center indicating this explosion gave an actual date. And then seeing this, I realized that this was not just an explosion that occurred out in space and had nothing to do with us. This is something that actually moved towards us and actually was able to trigger a supernova explosion. In fact, I spent a lot of time discussing the Crab supernova remnant.
Yes.
It appears that has been engineered. The shape, turns out it's a prolate ellipsoid, and it's the exact shape that the superwave event horizon has as it's viewed close to the present time, actually at the time of the explosion of that supernova remnant.
To orchestrate that shape, it was monumental. How do you think they did this?
That's the thing. You see this, and you're left in disbelief. It's like as if they created a map for us using a stellar explosion. It's oriented parallel to the galactic equator and rotated 90 degrees so we can see its shape. And that ellipse is the way the superwave event horizon looks to us, because if you take an ellipse, you have two points. One in this case would be the galactic center and the other the Earth. And so one of the lines you would draw out would be the cosmic rays going out to the horizon. And from the horizon would be the electromagnetic waves coming back to us. And that traces out an ellipse. And that's what we see is the galactic background, radio background radiation. It has that particular brightness pattern. In other words, a shape like that would explain that pattern.
What if the messages, Paul, don't come from extraterrestrials, but come from the Creator?
Yeah, that's always a possibility to consider. An option that's open to people to interpret this.
You have come up with a lot of interesting theories. There's another one in a book that you've written called Subquantum Kinetics. What is that?
Well, that's a physics theory that a whole new approach. And among other things, it solves a lot of problems that physics has currently run into. You would call it a unified field theory. It's bringing physics closer to the life sciences, like biology, sociology, this branch of science. Taking what I did is take systems concepts and bring them into physics. Physics had been an area where this hadn't been done before. And the concept that triggered this for me was the finding about Ilya Prigozhin's work and other scientists, Nicholas. They were writing about reaction-diffusion systems. Mm-hmm. These are, for example, chemical reactions that produce wave patterns. These are chemical waves. These are different from mechanical waves. This is something we've just discovered in the last 40 years or so. And so what I did was to say, suppose that there's an ether that's reacting just like a chemical reaction system.
All right.
Which was a totally new concept, because there was the ether concepts from the 100 years ago, but they were mechanical, like ethers, and they were talking about inert, sort of an inert substance that was unchanging. Now, this is different. This is where you have, it's like an alchemical process that's going on where etherons are reacting with each other and changing. And if you could imagine a fourth dimension in which these reactions are going on, and if you could map this out as an arrow, because they're going in one direction, all these reactions are going in one direction, and at one point in this process is where we're located. So you have to think fourth dimensionally here. So in a way that etherons are transmuting into our physical three-dimensional space and also leaving, transmuting out. And in that process, they're creating physical forms. And basically, I took the models that we've developed for chemical kinetics for explaining how chemical waves emerge in out of a initially uniform state and applied them to physics. For example, the Big Bang Theory is totally different from the Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory has everything coming in one explosion.
Which I don't think you believe in, do you?
No, well, I've disproved the Big Bang Theory, a paper I published in the Astrophysical Journal back in 1985. I took existing cosmological data, and I plotted the Big Bang Theory prediction, which is the expanding universe concept, and the tired light model, which is the idea that the universe is not expanding, but that the redshift of the light from the galaxies is due to a loss of energy. And consistently, the tired light model fell closer to the data trend. Now, why is this hadn't been discovered before? Well, usually cosmologists would plot their data only on one test, and then they would adjust their model to fit the data, and they called those evolutionary corrections. Now, what I did is I did a systems approach, and I presented four different cosmology tests all at once and put no assumptions in. And so you have a even playing field. Now, if the Big Bang theorists wanted to put in their evolutionary adjustments to pull their model closer to the data on one test, they would have to apply that same reasoning to the other test, and they would find their model goes further away. So it's like a Chinese handcuff. It's the ultimate test for a theory. And the paper was cited frequently, including by some of the top cosmologists who did reviews.
So you believe, basically, though, that matter energy is constantly being created.
Right. That's the alternative that I'm proposing, and that there's a continuous creation. There was no one big event. It's an event that's going on continuously. And
always was?
No. The ether was always there.
Okay.
Reacting, but you could say there was a beginning to the first particles of matter coming into being. But it could have been 100 trillion years ago. I mean,
sure.
You're not limited. See, the Big Bang Theory is limited by the light horizon, how
That's a good point. 14 billion years or a little less, right?
Yeah. You can't really stretch it much beyond that. It has to do with the rate of expansion that they perceive from the redshift. As soon as you get rid of that, you're not hemmed in by that any longer. And when you're dealing with continuous creation, it's an exponential growth process. And the part where it was just beginning to form, where particles were coming into being, had not yet formed stars, that would have been the longest part of your growth curve. In this physics, when gravity wells form, the process accelerates enormously because gravity wells create what I call supercritical regions. They're fertile regions. This whole system, it's a nonlinear physics that's involved here. In other words, the ether is it's a nonlinear process that's generating everything. And you have both supercritical and subcritical regions, just like this is terminology is referred to in a nuclear reactor. A nuclear reactor is a kind of nonlinear system. In a supercritical region, there tends to be amplification. And in the case of a nuclear reactor, it could go critical and explode.
If you're correct, what's the significance of your theory as opposed to the single Big Bang theory?
What is the significance?
Yes.
Okay, well, first of all, it fits the data better on the cosmology test. You take care of a lot of the problems that have emerged that have been cited about problems the Big Bang Theory has. For example, they see galaxies that are supposed to be only 600,000 years old, fully developed, and there's just not enough time for them to have formed. This wouldn't be a problem with continuous creation. They find these structures, immense structures, in space that are, for example, groupings of galaxies, superclusters, that have a periodicity. It's almost like a giant wave pattern that goes for 5 to 10 billion light years.
If this energy, Paul, is still being created, does that tell you then that this universe is growing at a tremendous clip? It's got to, right?
Right. In fact, the first of all, every body is, according to this physics, is growing at a certain rate. Now, the Earth, not very fast, but there are some theories that suggest, well, maybe the fact the continent separated wasn't due entirely to just the convective motions. There might have actually been a change of the radius of the planet. But there are certain restrictions there that you have to place. The fastest growth would be with the largest bodies. For example, the galactic core would be growing, creating matter within itself at the fastest rate, not only matter but energy. So this explains where these core explosions come from. In other words, this leads to a different theory of galactic cores, that they're not black holes. And in fact, a lot of astronomers now have turned away from black holes because they're finding all sorts of problems. For example, they find galaxies, quasars, where they formerly thought there was a black hole generating all this energy at the center, but yet they see that the area has been swept clean of dust, so there's nothing to power it, for it to gobble up. The same for our own galactic center. Matter moving out, but nothing moving in. The area near the center has been swept clean. So it's providing an answer there. I call these mother stars. They're indeed massive. Like in the case of the galactic core, it'd be 2 million solar masses approximately.
Do you believe, Paul, that there are other universes, parallel universes?
That's another thing that falls out of this is the possibility for parallel universes. They would be formed from the ether, sort of upstream, and there's certain criteria that are needed to form the universe. It's actually, believe it or not, very simple. The reactions can be very simple. You need two ether streams that are crossing and interacting, and to produce also a loop process. And the ancient myths have encoded this alchemic science, actually. For example, the Ankh, I believe the Egyptian Ankh, is a depiction of the reaction pattern that creates the universe.
How did they know all these things, though, Paul? That's what just boggles my mind. I mean,
you could theorize this way, that this isn't the first time they discovered reaction systems, chemical reaction systems that produce wave patterns. Maybe they discovered this long ago and developed a cosmology based on this phenomenon. Maybe it was knowledge was brought from another planet through contact. But again, on this theory, I've made so far 10 predictions that were documented that have been now verified. One of them, for example, is the explanation of the pioneer effect. You're familiar with this?
Oh, yeah, that's what, because of Pioneer 10 and 11, right?
Right.
When we launched those.
They were talking about a mysterious force pushing the craft towards the sun.
And then what did they assumed maybe planets had something to do with it. And, now these things are out of the solar system. who knows what's happening, right?
Right. Well, actually, back in 1980, this is before they even found this, I had contacted JPL, one of the people in that group, and asked them, see if they were interested in testing this theory, because my physics theory was predicting that photons in the galaxy should blue shift. In other words, remember I said that the galaxy would be a region, a supercritical region, where creating energy, whereas out in beyond the galaxy, in the space between the galaxies, you have subcritical region. That's why you get the redshifting out there. So that's a way of generating the redshift that they see. So anyway, I told them I expect a blue shifting of photons, and have they seen anything in their maser signals to the spacecraft that would indicate a blue shifting?
And they said, Paul, hold that right there. We'll come back at the top of the hour. We'll wrap up talking about the Pioneer Effect, and we'll take phone calls. Paul, before we get rolling into phone calls, you've got a number of books. I've read three of them already. Where can people get them?
Okay, if you don't have a computer and would like to call an 800 number, I can give that.
All right.
That's 1-800-715-9993.
Simple enough, 800-715-9993.
And if you have a computer, I have a website that's etheric.com. That's etheric.com.
Great. Can you also get these books from Amazon.com?
Some of them, not all of them. You can get Earth Under Fire and Genesis of the Cosmos. The Talk of the Galaxy, you could probably get it a little cheaper at my website. And there's other things that are at the website, like lectures, DVDs, things like that.
Briefly, with the Pioneer theory, if indeed the spacecraft seem to be speeding up, what does that tell us about the universe?
Okay, well, what I was saying is there was actually a frequency shift. It's not really that there's a force on the spacecraft causing it to move towards the sun. That it's due to the photons, the maser signal, changing its frequency in the time it takes to go over to the spacecraft and come back. And they're misinterpreting the blue shift. The blue shift means that the frequency has increased. They're misinterpreting the blue shift as a force pushing the spacecraft. Now, I had told them way back in 1980 about the prediction, and that same year had estimated the approximate magnitude, what they should see. And later that prediction was published and came out in 1985. Now, in 98, they finally announced what they found, and it came out within two standard deviations of what I had predicted.
That's not bad.
I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you're on the other end of the ball field and you hit the bullseye.
Have you ever been nominated for a Nobel Prize in Science?
Well, a friend of mine had said that that I should be nominated for two, but it hasn't happened yet. Now, that came out of another discovery of the finding that the heavy planets, the major planets, which are producing heat in their interiors, line up on the same relation as the red dwarf stars. In other words, if you plot the coordinates for each star, its mass and luminosity, you find it's on a trend, and you find the planets are in that same trend line. And it was doing those calculations that I came to make this prediction, namely that the reason the planets are generating energy in their interiors is because of this photon blue shifting effect. And I could get the magnitude from observing the heat outputs from the planets. Now, normally you would not make connection like that. It would be totally illogical in standard theories to make that connection. But I followed it, you know, and it turned out it confirmed the prediction.
All right, let's go to the phones, Paul, and see what our Coast listeners have in store for you. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, sir.
Happy Wednesday. This program ought to have some historical value. It's marvelous. I'm calling from Milwaukee area, north side of Milwaukee, Glendale, Wisconsin.
Oh, sure. Very familiar with
that. WISN radio.
Yes, sir.
Get a little publicity for a station. To your knowledge, did Nikola Tesla ever, so to speak, take a break from his electrical contrivances and delve into this terrestrial type of thing? To your knowledge, I would be inclined to think he would have the intellect to do it. That might be a part of the reason why the government took his records. It might have been stuff like this on his agenda and in his records. And there probably might be a little bit too much advanced knowledge to let go to the public. And the government probably didn't want that involved to the public. So that's my idea. Curious if you had any idea about Nikola Tesla's involvement in
any
this sort of thing.
Insight,
yeah, I don't offhand to tell you, although I've written a bit about Tesla's work. His Tesla waves are explained in subquantum kinetics. It's another form of wave that can be produced. It's longitudinal as opposed to the normal photon, which is a transverse type of wave. So both are explainable in subquantum kinetics. Tesla also believed in ether, and he was against the Einstein's idea of relativity, not the idea of time dilation and length for shortening, but the idea of relative frames. He didn't ascribe to that. The idea of abandoning the ether, he was not in agreement with.
I think, Paul, also one of the reasons why all his records were confiscated after he died is, you know, he had the knowledge of how to develop free electricity, free energy, and they didn't want anybody else to know about that. I'm convinced of that.
Also, his technology, yes, not only it's applicable to electric power production, but also to aviation, gravity control. One thing that comes out of subquantum kinetics is the prediction that electrons and protons have opposite gravity potentials, that you can create a gradient, which is, relates to Thompson Brown's work. And with Tesla's technique of pulsing, you can build up very large gradients in the ether that could create a very sizable force on an object.
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Seattle.
Well, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, this is Jay Widener. I was a guest on your show on April 5th.
Earlier this year. That's right, Jay. How are you? We talked about prophecy in 2012, right?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
And you have one of my very favorite scientists.
Hi, Jay.
Dr.
Good
Paul
to hear your voice.
As a matter of fact, you were on some of his credits on his videos, if
yes,
I remember.
I directed and wrote his Earth Under Fire video, actually.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job.
Nice
job.
Well,
thanks, Paul. You're really an amazing guy, and I'm so glad you're on Coast to Coast. And I just wanted to ask you a question here. Has any of your discoveries reinforce the ancient alchemical version of science, and what do you think of alchemy as a viable science?
The ancient Egyptians, for example, the word alchemy comes from alchemet, which translated means the science of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
If you study the Egyptian mythology, it's encoding a alchemic science, which is used to explain the creation of physical form. So there they were talking about an alchemic ether, an ether that's transmuting. Also, it was later, well, chemistry came out of alchemy. There was the attempt to look at chemical reactions with the idea that at room temperature, we can have transmutation of elements, just like you would have in a nuclear reactor. And so the idea of a modern-day field of cold fusion comes out of that. Yeah. So it has very ancient origins.
Well, Jay, what do you think of his thoughts about the Hopis, talking about, of course, the potential end of all of this?
Well, I think that Paul's actually right on, and I think that his work will grow in efficacy as time goes on. And I'm just so impressed with his work that I can't express it, and I'm so glad to have him on. And I'm so glad you're having John Major Jenkins on and really covering, George, the very, very important work that's going on concerning 2012, the Hopi, the Maya.
Oh, we're getting close to that date, Jay, aren't we?
Yes, we are, and it's very, very exciting. I think we're in for incredibly great changes, and I think Paul LaViolette is playing a major role in this, and I hope people are listening very closely to what he has to say.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. And you were a great guest when we had you on earlier this this April. Paul, this work that you've been doing into these areas. Now, we've talked about three separate areas, but they all seem to overlap as well. You know, the cosmic wave that could cause incredible havoc on this planet. The pulsars probably coming from extraterrestrials. Some of your work, and of course, the genesis of the cosmos. Is there one particular area, Paul, that you like the best?
Well, it's all fascinating. It's hard really to say. I totally would get into each area when I was writing the book, and it's a kind of stuff that completely shifts your paradigm. If you start reading, for example, Genesis of the Cosmos, your whole way of viewing reality will have changed by the time you finish. I am operating an entirely different reality than most people, I guess, who are adopting what's given out through the media. These are subjects that are reality shifting. If you didn't, for example, believe that there was any truth to these stories about the flood or the burning of the earth, and suddenly you see, well, here is an explanation, and it's something that's been totally ignored by astronomers and geologists. Your whole paradigm shifts when you realize these.
Let's go to our international line, Paul. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Where are you calling from?
This is British Columbia. Louise calling.
Hello, Louise. Go ahead. Paul's with you.
Yes, Paul. I wanted to know, can we personally feel these pulses that are sent to Earth as human beings? Can we feel these?
When you're talking about super waves?
Yes.
Okay, it's something that hasn't arrived yet now, and when it arrives, you'll know it. It will, like what we've been going through now is like sunny weather. Even all this concern about solar flares. The first thing you would feel, I imagine, would be earthquakes happening simultaneously around the planet. Then would be the gamma ray burst. Which if you were outdoors, the question is how strong would it be, whether it would give you a large dose of radiation. These are things to be concerned about. That would be passing very quickly, and then would be the pushing of the cosmic dust into the solar system, and that would be a much more long-term thing because these effects last for hundreds, even thousands of years. We're talking about generations and generations of people having to go through this.
So you don't see that there are certain people here already who are aware of perhaps these messages that are being sent?
Okay, so sent, in other words, from advanced civilizations?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you're talking more about messages, telepathic messages?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I am aware. Now, the thing is that people have gotten messages in the past, and they thought something was going to happen on a certain date, and it didn't work out. So the problem is, you know, the person may actually be getting a message, but is it coming from a credible source? And that we don't know. You know, so if these civilizations were sending us a message, what would help us is if they said, okay, here's how you build a telescope that's able to sense superluminal signals, for example, and detect this before it gets to you, so you can see it coming, whether that's possible or not. You know, so there is this question of track record, you know, because in the past predictions have not panned out, but it doesn't mean we should not expect something soon. You know.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there, where are you calling from?
Calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Paul, this is a voice you haven't heard in quite a while.
This is a voice I've heard quite a bit. It's our science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland. Hey,
good
Richard.
Good evening, George.
What sparked you to call?
Well, Paul is, I heard Jay call in, and obviously Jay and I have discussed Paul extensively because we discussed Paul's work, and I've known Paul for ages. I haven't talked to him in quite a while. But I would echo what Jay said. I mean, Paul is doing some extremely important work. I could have some quibbles about details, but that's not important. I do have a couple of questions I wanted to ask him.
Yeah, go ahead.
One is, I understand, Paul, that your superwave model, where the galaxy center explodes periodically and basically blasts the solar system and Earth and causes a really bad hair day for everybody living here, occurs roughly on a cycle every 26,000 years. Am I correct on that?
I see also a period of 13,000 being in there, too.
Which is the half cycle.
Right.
Okay.
We're talking about the major climate-changing events.
Right.
This is not to mention the smaller events, which wouldn't change climate.
Yep. So you're connecting those periodicities with the explosion at the center of the Milky Way, right?
Right.
Okay. Really important question I've been dying to ask you for a while. Isn't it phenomenal that that's exactly the period and half period of the Earth's precession?
Well, I discussed that in my book.
How do you match those?
Well, that would indicate that there's a gravitational component to the superwave.
So there's some kind of connection between the galactic center and the solar system.
Yeah, what it's doing is applying a torque to the Earth, because the axis of the Earth, when these arrive, like, for example, when the last one arrived towards the end of the Ice Age, the Earth's axis was pointed, towards the galactic center, was leaning towards. So the Earth's equator was maximally inclined at that time. Now, if you are subjected to a tidal force due to a gravity wave coming from the galactic center at that time, it would produce a maximum torque to cause precession of the axis at that time.
Okay.
So what happens is that the precession of the Earth ends up synchronizing with that periodic pull.
Like basically pushing someone on a swing at exactly the right time.
Exactly. And so, in other words, what it means is not all of the force that's causing the precession of the axis is coming from the sun and moon.
Right.
That a major part of that is the galactic superwave.
Okay, now here's the little devil in the details. If that's true, and this wave, of course, is much vaster than the entire solar system, so it impacts all the planets, why don't all the planets have the same precessional period?
Do we know that well enough? Like, which planets are you talking about?
Really good data now from Mars, because we got guys sitting on the surface, you know, spacecraft with very, you know, careful narrowband radio receivers the DSN listens to.
Mm-hmm.
We've got spacecraft orbiting Jupiter and Saturn, and, you know, we really kind of wire the solar system, and the only place that has this incredible synchronicity seems to be the Earth, which, of course, I find really mysterious and troubling, and I have some other possible answers, but we won't get into
that.
You're
right. That would cause some problems for that theory.
All right, Richard, hey, thanks for that call, enterprisemission.com. Always nice to get impromptu calls from the science advisor, Richard C. Hoagland, and we'll be back with more with our guest, Paul LaViolette, and your calls. Final calls, because next hour, open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Dr. Paul LaViolette, our guest, and we're going to take your phone calls. I've got open lines next hour. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Paul, right before the clock got us at the mid-break, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, had called in and basically wanted to know who had the greatest interest in telling us if there was some catastrophe that periodically comes from the center of the galaxy. And he thought, of course, it was us from Mars. What do you think?
Say again, what was that he was saying?
Well, he believes that it might have been us when we were once Martians. Richard has always believed that we came from Mars in some form or fashion.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. You know, but I wanted to comment about what he had brought up about the gravity wave theory that I was suggesting, that Mars' pole is not in phase in the same cycle. This is the only other planet, apparently, we have good data in terms of actual having spacecraft landed on it. Well, one difference is that we have a large moon that Mars doesn't. The moon there is very small and doesn't really exert very large force on the planet compared to what we have here. So tidal effects are much larger on the Earth due to the moon we have. And I'm just thinking that maybe that could be the thing that's the difference as why this effect would cause this synchronization in the case of the Earth. As to why the moon would make that difference, I can't really say right now, but it's something to think about.
You know, when we talked in the first hour about the cosmic wave, that we really won't know if and when it hits us, but do we get any kind of indication that something's going on? I mean, do we see any kind of climate change or anything that we might be able to relate directly to something like a cosmic wave?
That I don't know. You know, we're all going through this for the first time when we finally are on the threshold of this. So we're on the learning curve, so to speak. One thing we can do is keep careful watch on the galactic center and look at the activity, what's going on there. And if things started acting up, you know, maybe that would give us some warning. You know, suppose it didn't happen all at once. There was some building up of activity there, and hopefully would have enough time to have the astronomers discussing this and taking some preparation. But as to whether that will happen, don't really know.
All right, back to the phones we go, west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Cody.
Hi, Cody. Where might you be?
I'm calling from San Diego.
Ah, okay. Go ahead, Cody.
Yeah, my question is, I recently found that there were two comets in our vicinity, in Earth's vicinity, during the tsunami last year. And my question was, if you or anyone has heard about this, I haven't heard anything in the media, and if you think that it really could have had anything to do with the tsunamis, it's actually the tsunami that happened.
Well, I don't think so. The gravitational pull of a comet would be very small to have done anything like that.
The Macholtz was 0.376 light years, and the linear looks like it was 1.156, and looks like that was down towards the southern pole. And the Macholtz, it looks like it's directly being shot out from the Orion constellation.
But you do believe it was a gamma burst that had something to do with it, Paul, right?
Yeah, just the synchronicity. Two of the largest events in their class in the last 30 years or so to have occurred and to be so close in time. Either the universe is playing tricks on us, or there must be some connection.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Linda. I'm from Omaha.
Uh-huh.
I'm so happy to talk to you. I listen to you every night. I just love your show.
Thank you, Linda.
And I was I had two quick questions for Paul because while I was sitting here, I just thought of one that kind of pertained to what was happening with these signals, and I wondered if he might think this might have something to do with it. Supposedly, Thoreau, in his Emerald Tablet, said that at some time there would be a great danger that had come to the Earth before from deep in space, and that he actually put this spaceship from Atlantis, that the race had come here, like the Anunnakians had come here in, and they had buried it beneath the Sphinx. And he said that the spaceship that we could use to go and stop whatever this danger was. And I actually had a friend who worked the Philadelphia experiment
back in the 40s.
Yeah, and he said that that was true, that there was, they had found a spaceship underneath the Sphinx.
Oh, that's an interesting find, if that's possible. Does he have any pictures?
I don't know. You know, he's got some really good stories about some projects that went on, and knowing that the government actually had like a Stargate that actually went to the moon, and he said on the moon there's actually a bench that Noah had like carved his name into the bench when he was a child, that I guess it was Inke or Inlay or one of them had taken him up to the up there to this star base they had, or this space they had up there. And I guess being a kid, he was sitting up there on the bench and he like put his initials in it.
Well, Paul, let me ask you, of course, you know, we talked about, and Linda, thanks for your call, the Hopis and, you know, the possibilities that they have sketches of extraterrestrials. Do you believe that this planet's been visited in the past?
Yes, yes. One thing, for example, the Pulsar message, they're calling attention to certain of our constellation stars. And so they would have to have knowledge of our constellation lore. For example, the Sagitta, the pointer star of the point of the arrow, the Sagitta arrow, that's the one that's closest to the one radiant point, is being marked by the second fastest pulsar. And with a certain geometrical relationship, there's like a right angle triangle formed. It's the diagram on the website shows this. And so when you see this calling attention to certain things that are in our own lore, you begin to wonder either they learned it from us or maybe they taught us this constellation lore and it was handed down. Either that or these are incredible coincidences.
Well, and I don't believe in coincidences, Paul.
For example, the zodiac, astrological zodiac, Leo and Aquarius constellations, their astrology lore says, for example, that Leo is the warm sign and Aquarius the cool sign. And this is marking out the dipole anisotropy of the 3-degree Kelvin radiation field. To observe that, because that's microwave radiation in space, but we had to have ability to fly above the atmosphere and had very sophisticated microwave receiving equipment and so on. So how did the, if this was just the ancients, how did they know to put those characterizations on those signs? And not only that, they actually mapped out the temperature gradient by using a symbol system of planet assignments, for example. And also they assign certain astrological signs to body parts. The ones closer to Leo are towards the heart, the area of warmer temperature in the body. And as you go towards Pisces and Aquarius, you go like to the feet, you're going down in body temperature.
Somebody somewhere wants to save this planet. Why?
Well, they see that we're less advanced and they want to give us a hand to get over the hurdle. I think this is the big test of a civilization. If you can make it through the superwave to defend your planet and not go into a dark ages afterwards, then you have passed the test. You're able to advance and be part of the galactic club, so to speak. There may be, I mean, we're speculating here, maybe there is a prime directive that they're not to interfere, that they can give hints, they can show us.
Send pulsars, but they can't directly.
Right, they can show us these amazing things like spelling out E equals MC squared. I mean, it's almost really equivalent to that. I mean, what you're seeing with a pulsar is if you wrote with one of these stunt airplanes in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like flashing. There's like a flashing neon sign is the way to put it. And if we can't get our act together when they've been so explicit to point this out, not only with pulsars, but with the lores that have been passed down, carefully preserved through the oral traditions and even in spiritual traditions. I mean, every religion is passing down about these cataclysms. It's considered so important that we're supposed to be informed about this, to be prepared.
What if they were time travelers, Paul, and somehow they know what's going to happen, and they're warning us, maybe through these pulsars, and I wish we would decode them?
And my own personal view is that it's possible to go into the future, like if you're traveling near the speed of light.
Right.
But if you're talking about time travel to the past, I don't believe it's possible to go into the past from as physical beings. We can pass to other dimensions. That's what happens when we die. Our soul passes out of the physical. But to actually see, I believe this is like a movie that's running. Sort of like the flux, the ether flux, it's a universal, unidirectional flux that's going on. And it's difficult, you can't just reverse that, you know, and go back. Unless it would be like a Matrix type of scenario where you could, where it was all a computer program that you could just rewind. But I don't think that's the way it works.
No, I wish it were that easy. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Hello? Nope, you're gone. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jean.
Hi,
I'm
Jean.
In Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I tried for a very long time to call you. I have a four-line poem that I want to read you that's been given to me in 2000 by whom I don't know. But I know that it's important for the native people in this country. It's called Message. Modern mankind, spiritually blind, ant and bee no more than thee. Look about, earth will shout. Native peoples hold the key.
Very good.
But it's, my question is, along with this, there's been a lot of stuff, you know, that I come upon, how I don't know, but it's as if to me, the earth is like a giant, or not the earth, but the whole universe is like a gigantic, living, very spiritual thing. And what we see going in the going away is it's simply growing, like cells grow. And everything that we see out there is simply a component of that enormous, like, body that is a large spiritual thing.
Yes. Even the ether.
Exactly.
And you can view the ether as being sacred, and that's the way the ancients viewed it. Yes. Even to the point of possibly being conscious, of some form of consciousness at that level.
Thanks for being on the program, Gene. First time caller line, you're on with Paul LaViolette on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello.
Yeah,
this is
go ahead.
Mike from Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like Dr. Paul to clear up an inconsistency that I see. There's this destructive wave that comes out every maybe 26,000 years in the center of the galaxy, right?
Yeah.
Now, I assume it's a spherical wave. It's not directed at Earth.
Right.
Right, okay. And I believe you said you, in some circumstances, you think it's caused supernova. There's Earth has caught on fire. Is 26, now if this goes out through the entire galaxy, how do any extrasolar civilizations develop enough to be able to manipulate neutron stars?
Okay, as far as the Earth catching on fire, that's not due directly to the cosmic rays, but to the sun becoming activated. Now, the reason why we're having a rough time right now is that there's a lot of cosmic dust in the vicinity of the sun. There was a time where we didn't have ice ages, which indicates that the hazards were not as severe as they are now. In other words, think of us that we're currently passing through a dirty part of the galaxy. So when these superwaves arrive, you get this climatic change, the sun becoming extremely aggravated and doing coronal mass ejection. Now, the waves would be much more severe closer to the galactic center. Suppose now that civilizations which were advanced, which actually set these sites up, had the ability to travel at faster than the speed of light. They would have the ability to actually go through a superwave without it affecting them and go onto the other side. In other words, when they come out of subspace or whatever you want to call it, because you'd have to have your ship partially dematerialized to travel superluminally.
Sure.
I hope this isn't going over people's heads. There is a way to do this. According to subquantum kinetics, you raise the gravity potential. When you raise gravity potential, objects begin to dematerialize. Not entirely. You can have it so it's just a bunch of point masses without the waves in between, but it looks invisible. That would minimally interact with dust particles and so on that you would be going through. You'd be able to then rematerialize once you got through this.
And that's probably the way they do it. Paul, your 3 hours were up. I want to thank you for being on the program. We started you earlier, and it's a little different. It worked out. His toll-free number, by the way, if you're interested in his books that we've been talking about tonight, 800-715-9993. His website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com.